Well, folks, according to my clock, and I'm known to be genetically punctual, it's time. It's time. So welcome and good morning, everyone. My name is Michelle Simpson. I'm the moderator of this panel. And I almost feel like a flight attendant, but I'm going to do it anyway. So if you are here for Sex and Cinema, Representations of Women and Sexuality in the Arts, you're on the right place. You do not need to deplane. So you can... Okay, and I thought I was in my teacher's voice, but I will do this. Let me move this over. How's that? Is that better? Perfect. So, again, welcome. And in terms of welcoming you, I want to, again, say that today's panel is devoted to a discussion of sex and cinema, representations of women and sexuality in the arts. Since these sessions are, in fact, taped, I want to make certain to take a moment and allow those kind of magical tapers to know that the date is Friday, 12 April 2019, and this session is numbered 4203. Again, 4203. My name is Michelle Simpson. I'm a faculty member here on campus, and I believe the reason why I was asked to moderate this panel is because I teach several classes in the arts and sciences. One of those classes is gender, sexuality, in popular culture, and another one of those classes is women, literature, and the arts. But be warned, another class that I've been teaching since probably 1995, 1996 is ethics. So watch out, folks. Okay? Just watch out. You've been warned. But again, welcome. And it is my pleasure to, in a moment, welcome our panelists as well. But before I do that, I also want to mention how we can interact with you, you with us. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system. If you need a note card, fabulous, fabulous. Laura Faith over there will hand you one, and she can help you with anything else that you may need help with during this discussion. So you can also, as I said, use the app note card system to receive questions. And to ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand, as I just mentioned, to request a note card from Laura and pencil from one of our producers. And it looks like we have a producer. Am I correct? So Laura's the producer. You must write legibly, folks. We want to hear from you, but let us hear from you in a way that we can understand your question or comment. If you are a student, let me underscore that. If you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. Make your questions brief and to the point. So, here we go. We have three panelists with us today. The panelist to my left is Julia Spiker-Kasdorf. And to her left, we have Priya Jha. And next to her, we have Lux Alptrum. I didn't want to mess it up, didn't want to cannibalize anybody's name, so I think I got it.
You did great.
And we got together beforehand and chatted a bit about how we wanted to kind of begin. And I asked each one of the panelists if they would be willing, especially since this is Friday. Many of the panelists have been on other panels. They've been, again, here at the conference for a portion of the week. If they wouldn't mind kind of moving off text a bit. In other words, if you have your conference booklet, you can find kind of the what I call, and you may not, so I hope not to offend anybody, kind of the boilerplate bios, and feel free to look at those. But I've asked each one of the panelists to introduce themselves and perhaps share something with us that may not be on the bio or a part of that bio. So we can start, we don't have to start in any particular order. Who wants to go first by sharing something, again, with all of us here today about yourself? Perhaps it's not included. Why don't we start with you, Lux, because you caught my eye.
Sure. So my name is Lux Alptrum. I'm a writer whose beat is sex, pop culture, and feminism. I'm also the author of Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal, which is available for sale at Mackey and wherever books are sold. So what's not in my bio, I believe it's not in my bio, but is very relevant to this conversation, is that I spent a number of years running Thank you. Actually, so back when I was in college at the turn of the century, I became very, very interested in what was then the burgeoning scene of internet porn. And I was specifically interested in the fact that there were many people who were independent creators, oftentimes just college students, who were creating sites that were challenging what they saw in mainstream pornography and challenging, just offering up different depictions of what was sexy, what kind of sex was acceptable, what kind of bodies were acceptable to be featured or to be considered sexy. So I found that really, really powerful. And I ended up doing some modeling, running a small site of my own. And then a few years later, my experience doing that ended up being part of the reason why I was recruited by Gawker Media to write for and then run a site called Fleshbot, which was at the time Gawker Media's sex and porn blog, where we covered everything sexy of all manner of things and oftentimes wrote about sex in the cinema as well as pornography. And yeah, I ran that for Gawker for many years and then ran it independently for 2 years before selling it. And so I have a lot of thoughts about this topic.
Lux, thank you very much. Priya, why don't you kind of take the mic?
All right, good morning, and thank you for coming out on this cold, cold day. My name is Priya Jha, and I am a professor at University of Redlands in the English department, where I also teach, I'm part of, at a core level, in women's gender sexuality studies and race and ethnic studies, and I'm one of the founding members of Media and Visual Cultures. What I think about in relation to this topic goes back a very long way to my experience of being an Indian woman. And so I'm going to talk about some of this in relation to my own biography and coming to awareness of myself as, you know, in terms of my sexuality, my gender, et cetera. At University of Redlands, which is where I work, which is in Southern California, where it's a lot warmer. I also laugh a lot, and I tell bad jokes, so you should just be prepared. I teach a course called Gender Nation, which is a women's studies course. I also teach another class that's crossed between race and ethnic studies and women's gender sexuality studies called Race, Sex, and Gender in Popular Culture. I teach courses in popular culture and film primarily, and sometimes I pretend I teach literature. And it's true. Ask my students. I'm writing about a book right now, and it's kind of weird because I don't write about literature, and so this has kind of taken me a little bit, caught me off guard. But anyhow, when I was in school here, I'm an alum of CU Boulder. I got my PhD here in comparative literature, and during that time, you know, my work on sexuality in cinema dates back to that. I took two fantastic courses that changed the trajectory of my work. One was theories of spectatorship. I do a lot of work on feminism and spectatorship theory. And as well, I took a class called Cinema and Sexuality, which really rocked my world. And so, you know, I got to think about sexuality in a very different way than I had been used to. I wrote my master's thesis on Black gay British cinema. And my PhD work was on the figure of Mother India. My work is on gender, sexuality, and nationalism, and within colonial contexts. So I trace so much of it, you know, back to colonial history. So that's kind of where I live. And I have been writing for the last 26 years about Hindi cinema and Bollywood. So I have an essay on male bonding and something else, male bonding and friendship in 1970s Hindi action films. Oh, it kicks ass. I also say things like ass. And hope you can deal with that. You should see my students. I like what I do because it's so much fun, and I get to think about topics that perhaps have not readily been explored in the scholarship on Hindi cinema. Although I'm not doing that work right now these days. I'm doing work on design, so it's a little bit different. But what I've been interested in for a long time is the convergence of nationalism, sexuality, and women. How is it that women are portrayed in film in India? How does that connect to certain notions of what a woman should and should not be? You know, and also men.
That's great.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I've been doing for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really looking forward and how it converges with nationalism and the emergent nationalism after independence in 1947. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm teaching a class on Bollywood right now, and we just finished a module on this very topic. Right. So I think I'm a little bit fresh on it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Julia Spiker-Kasdorf, and I probably am the least immersed in the world of cinema. I'm a Polish. But I think this is why they included me on the panel. I'll tell you the names of some of my books. I have a collection of essays called The Body in the Book, Writing from a Mennonite Life. Mm-hmm. Three books of poems from in the Pit Poetry series, Sleeping Preacher, Eve's Striptease, and Poetry in America. And my recent project is a documentary collaborative project with Stephen Rubin, and the title of that book is Shale Play, Poems and Photographs from the Fracking Fields. So what's that have to do with sex? I teach poetry writing at Penn State, and my comments today I think are going to have a lot to do with just coming out of what I observe in my students' writing, and I'm really pleased to see so many students here, and I hope they will share their thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I don't know how many people here in this room had an opportunity, it was just about a week ago, to come to campus and hear Viola Davis. I don't know if anybody had an opportunity. Okay, I see a lone hand out there. Viola Davis, again, well-known actress, was here just about a week ago, and I wanted to share a comment that she made that evening with the panel and get your response and kind of launch things that way, if you don't mind.
Great.
So she was talking about being in the film Widows. The film begins with me, this is Viola Davis speaking, the film begins with me in bed with Liam Neeson, and we're kissing. And it's a sexualized kiss. Here I am. I'm dark, I'm 53, I'm in my natural hair, and I'm with Liam Neeson. I'm with what America would consider to be a hunk. He's not my slave owner. I'm not a prostitute. It's not trying to make any social or political statements. We're simply a couple in love. And what struck me in the narrative is that I'd never seen it before. And you're not going to see it this year. You're not going to see it next year. You're not going to see it the year after that.
So I love that statement. I think it's such an important statement to make, because one of the commonalities with a lot of stuff about media and media across genres, so yes, porn, yes, mainstream cinema, yes, TV, music, all of that, is that a lot of what we see is gatekept, I suppose, is restricted by the people at the top who are choosing what is going to be seen, what is going to be distributed, what is quote-unquote marketable. And that often has a huge effect in the types of sex that we see on screen, because the decision makers are predominantly white men, and often older white men, and often straight older white men, who have a very specific idea of what is sexy, what is acceptable, who gets to be sexual on screen, and what kind of sex is appropriate on screen. I think it's really telling that it's so rare for us to see older women depicted as sexual beings. Like, Grace and Frankie is one of the few shows that I can think of that does that. And I think Widows also, to see like an older black woman portrayed as a sexual being and a sexual being in control of her own experience and her own relationship, and with, as the quote mentions, with someone who is widely considered to be a desirable man. I think we don't get to see that because we don't get to see people like Steve McQueen telling the story very often. We certainly don't get to see women of color and black women and indigenous women telling the story very often, and that shapes what kind of presentation of sex we see in cinema.
You know, you raised two points, which are, that I'm drawing from. One is this notion of censorship that was embedded in your comment. And in 1992 in India, there was a film that came out called Kalinayak, which means villain. And the film was almost censored. Okay, it kind of got censored because there was a song in the film that went like, what's behind the veil, what's underneath your, what's behind the blouse, what's underneath your veil. And it's a very sexualized dance performance. And the censors, I don't know if you know this, but in India, before a film goes through a censorship process. Before it can be screened. And there was a huge public outcry. The fundamentalist Hindus who were in power at that time were so angry. They're, you know, I mean, some people in the general public, but primarily, you know, the Hindus that were in power. And they saw that as the sexuality that the main character portrayed as somehow decrying or insulting Indian, who we are as Indians, you know. I mean, within an Indian context, that's always been the case. So, you know, I have friends who have written about this, but there's, you know, and I think that touches upon decide who are these censors. You know, and particularly when the censorship process in India goes back to the colonial period, it goes back to the British. And so there's a very long trajectory of that. And there was another point that, but I've now since forgotten.
We can come back to it.
We can come back to it. Yeah, if it comes to you. Julia, is there something you wanted to say about that?
I would just say that I think it's really powerful to see those images. It's also really important to think about, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot in relation to this panel, how our own sense of what is desirable is constructed. So, like, what's sexy?
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Yeah.
You know, I have a question that came from the audience, and I'd like to share it, if you don't mind, and we can just intersperse. And the question is as follows. The panel is all women. Do men have anything to do with this discussion?
I think men have been leading this discussion for decades. So, I mean, do men? Yeah, of course men have something to do with this discussion, but we have seen men's vision of what women and sex in cinema looks like. You can go into pretty much every movie theater, pretty much every movie, and see it. So, while I'm not opposed to hearing men's views, I think we have heard quite a lot of them.
What men think is appropriate and sexy is also constructed by these images. I've been watching, there are multiple trailers for Gone with the Wind posted on the internet. And I've been watching them with the sound off. So the images of the romantic slaves is like one conversation that would have to be addressed. But every one of the trailers includes Rhett Butler drunk, grabbing Scarlett and carrying her up the grand staircase to rape her. Yeah. And usually that's followed by her waking up, stretching her arms and smiling. And then the next scene is something burning in the south. So aggression, violence, what's okay for men to do.
And lack of consent.
The only thing I would like to add to all of this is that I think where we are now in the 21st century, I think notions of masculinity and manhood are changing. And so how do we attend to that? And so I think that's another conversation that I think will be forthcoming. I think we're right on the cusp right now. I mean, I certainly see it with my students, you know, who are between 18 and 22. You know, there's a very different sense of what it means to be in the world. So, you know, definitely that's going to be part. You know, I think how do we fold them in? What does that look like?
Well, and presumably things have changed since Gone with the Wind, which was, what, 1939?
Yeah.
Somewhat.
I have another question here. It's been said that in terms of cinema, sex is in general out. Violence, often deliberately unreal, is in. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that we have a higher tolerance in this culture specifically, in American culture, we have a higher tolerance for violence than we do for sex. There's this movie many of you have probably seen called The People vs. Larry Flint, which is about Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, and his many free speech court cases. And I remember watching it on TV when I was in high school. And there's a scene where he is making a point about our tolerance for violence versus our tolerance for sex. And he is just interspersing like violent images and sexual images. And he's like, you know, how come some of these are acceptable? How come some of these are not? The thing that was really funny was that because I was watching it on broadcast TV, all of the sexual images were censored, which like really, really, really drove home the point. I think, you know, certainly on premium cable, there's more comfortability with sex. I think in certain corners, there is more comfortability with sex. But the kind of sex that we're comfortable with is often very limited. In the cinema, a scene of cunnilingus is likely to be rated likely to receive a more restrictive rating, like more likely to be NC-17 than a blowjob or a different kind of sex. I think it's not so much that we can't have sex in cinema or that we never do, but there's a lot more discomfort around it, whereas extreme violence is often viewed as totally fine. And I think the way that we determine, like, what is PG-13, what is acceptable for young people, and what is too adult, is really interesting and something that we should be pushing back on.
Would anybody else like to comment on that?
Yeah. You know, within an Indian context, what you're saying takes me back to my childhood, which is, I mean, it's a very different aesthetic than Hollywood. And I won't get into that right now. You know, you would have these violent fight sequences that were separate from anything around sex or sexuality. And for a long time, sexuality was forbidden, like any depiction of love. So you know, you didn't have the first kiss in Hindi cinema till 1990. And even then, people weren't doing it. Now it's different because it's a globalized system, right? Mm-hmm. So it's radically different now. But Priyanka Chopra changed everything. But you should see her Hindi movies. They're really good. For a long time, when you saw it wasn't as if sex and sexuality were missing. They were there, particularly for women, because you had to, you know, these were movies for a mass audience, and you had to titillate the audience, right? But you couldn't show kisses, you couldn't show nudity, you couldn't show, you know, all of these different things. So this is the way you did it. Feel free to laugh. So, during a song, let's say that's about love, if it was about a kiss, you would see flowers. Like, you know, they would just fade out and then there would be flowers. And then if there was sex, there was fire. And then our lovely heroine would show up pregnant.
That's totally how it happens.
But this was so, you know, sex and sexuality were something to be kept hidden. And part of it was a kind of, this is not what we do. This is not our culture. You know, but also about how it tied into notions of what a woman's role should be. You know, the other way it worked, too, was during the 60s and 70s, you would have Western women and Eastern Indian women,
depicted around sexuality. And the Indian woman would always wear saris. It was all done around costuming. She would always wear saris. She was a good girl. She worshipped. She prayed, blah, blah, blah. Then you'd have the Western woman who wore mini skirts. And, you know, I mean, she was, you know, and she'd always be shown with a cigarette in one hand and a glass of whiskey in the other. And then she would die. Because she had to die. She showed something. You know, and all of these things were, you know, kind of, I love my work. All of these things were kind of really intertwined with one another. And so, you know, there was a struggle about what it meant to be Indian. And it was all tied into the figure of the woman.
Let's look at another question, Angelia. If I could start with you. What are some of the societal consequences of the way women are presented in cinema?
Well, I think... So, I read about 40 drafts of poetry written by undergraduate students and graduate students every week. So 40 new poems. And once a week, once every 2 weeks, I read a poem about sexual assault. And this is the thing I've been thinking about a lot. Mm-hmm. And this is the experience I bring to this conversation. Because... you know, it's so common on university campuses. Maybe it's more common where I am. It's a Big Ten school, football culture. There's a big bar culture. There's a big Greek life. There's a lot of drinking. But I'm not sure what... And I'm not claiming causation, but correlation. What constructs... our sense of what's okay, what's permissible. And I know that there are all these efforts on campuses to talk about consent, but what's happening with that? And are the images, if you, you know, how many movies start with a dead woman? Or a woman who's struggling? Or how many, even just like that kiss, that always happens, you know? The kiss, and then the music comes up. And the camera zooms in. I don't know. I'm just... So these are things I've been thinking about. And just here's some notes I scribbled down. Do we want to be swept away? To be ravished? To lose control? To succumb? To be raped? Do we want to be admired, seduced, pursued, stopped? And relating to the last question, what's the place of violence in desire? And I don't know the answer to those things, but those are things that I keep wondering about.
So I would say one of the points that I think about a lot is that the best thing and the worst thing about sex in the cinema, and again, this is really any depiction of sex in the arts in any medium, the best thing and the worst thing is that it's a fantasy. And the great thing about it being a fantasy is we can envision sexuality in ways that we know we cannot experience in real life. Clearly, 50 Shades of Grey, whatever you think about it, that was something that was titillating for many people, and it was a nice escape fantasy. It was not something that I think should be someone's real sex life or relationship for many reasons, but it was a titillating fantasy for people. And it can be nice to just indulge in a fantasy where we don't have to talk about the condom. We don't have to have these long conversations about what you want and what you want, and where it all just magically works. But a problem is that it's a fantasy. And it's a fantasy that we experience in a culture where we don't have good sex education, where we don't openly talk about sexuality, and where we don't put that fantasy into context. So I think that that, combined with the fact that that we're seeing the fantasies primarily of straight white men, that's when it starts to become harmful. Because number one, we're seeing the same image over and over and over and over again. So we get it reinforced that this is what sex is supposed to be like, this is how women are supposed to be. This is how it's all supposed to function. And we don't have a broader dialogue to push back on that. I mean, because the answer really is that sex is whatever you want it to be and whatever feels good for you and the person that you are consensually having sex with. And that could, to your point, that could involve consensual violence or force that ideally negotiated and, again, consensual and discussed and done safely. That could involve something just tender and loving and sweet and quiet. That could involve all manner of different things, and that's all okay. But we don't really get that diversity in film, and we don't have the conversations that say it is up to you what is sexy, not up to the culture.
You know, the questions are rolling in. Yeah.
Thank you.
And so I want to try and make certain to get to as many as possible.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to kind of just try to keep it moving a bit here. Here's another question. Please jump in. How do we include trans women and trans feminine people's voices in these conversations?
For starters, we have to support media made by trans women and
yes.
trans feminine people.
Absolutely.
There's a web series called Her Story that was created. It was about the dating lives of trans and queer women. It's fantastic. Definitely look it up. I'm trying to think about, there's not enough trans-created media that gets traction, but certainly we need to support it and we need to amplify it and, again, create more diverse voices.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I think back to Boys Don't Cry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which was such an important
mm-hmm.
film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a film that really, I think, was trying to usher in a conversation. And that conversation fell flat, exactly for the reason that you bring up, Lux.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the absence, the kind of vacuum of seeing that. And I think, you know, and a lot of films that feature trans characters or are done by trans people wind up being put under, you know, a kind of, quote, cinema, as opposed to movies. And I think that's part of the problem. We need to begin seeing these representations in more mainstream
mm-hmm.
films.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed, you know, I think about some of the films I might show in my classes, right? But students are not going to have access to them outside these courses.
Right.
May I just go back really quickly to your point that you made earlier?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was mm-hmm. thinking about race,
mm-hmm.
and how do we talk about race? And I was thinking about a scene from the 1957 film Imitation of Life,
mm-hmm.
if anyone's seen it.
Oh, yeah.
I teach it all the time. It's such a great
yeah.
movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen it, you should.
Yeah.
But in the film, and I'm sorry, it's been a while, so my characters, and I'm going through, like, major, you know, memory vacuums. So, but anyway, there's a character in that film who's the daughter of a black woman, and the daughter looks white, and she passes throughout the film. And she completely rejects her mother, and there's a certain way in which she comports herself through wearing sexy clothes, whereas the white daughter in this kind of fake family is always good. She's always wearing like these little princessy dresses and everything. But there's a very important scene in the movie where, the mixed race girl winds up falling in love with this white boy. And they've been dating for a while, it appears. And then there's a scene where he finds out that she actually is black. And he smacks her around. I mean, it's an incredibly violent scene. You know, and he pushes her away and he's like, I can't believe, you know, something to the effect of, you know, get away from the disgust for him. And he leaves and she's left lying in this alley and, you know, just crying and bloodied, and she can't understand. But to me, you know, this conversation around violence and sex, you know, this film really speaks to that. And I think we really need to bring race into this because they're very different ways of talking about sex, sexuality, and race. So, I mean, you know, I don't know if people have questions about that, but that might be something, I would like to hear about from you.
We have another question from a student in the audience. Why is it often men in porn are older and younger women instead of vice versa? Then parenthetically, why are older men more sexualized?
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I just want to mention Pose on FX is another great trans-created show. Sorry for blanking on that. As the resident porn expert, I will say that I don't know that I would say that older men are more sexualized per se, specifically when we're talking about porn, because in porn, men are not portrayed as sexual objects. They are more often portrayed as sexual actors.
Exactly.
And sexual subjects. And so you see, I mean, number one, the thing that you have to understand about pornography and what kind of male performers get cast is that if you are a cis man in porn, a big part of your job is being able to maintain an erection and ejaculate pretty much on command and maintain an erection for a really long time. And maybe that doesn't sound like that hard a job, but you have to remember, no pun intended, you have to remember you're on a set, there's camera lights, it's not comfortable, you're in positions you don't like, you might not be attracted to your co-star, there's somebody yelling at you because your angle is wrong. It's a really difficult job. And so there really aren't that many men who can do it and do it well and do it consistently. And so when they wind up in the industry, they stay there. They book a lot of work and they stay there. And they have more longevity than their female co-stars, in part because it's a really specialized job that not everybody can do. But there's also the fact that because a lot of porn consumers are straight men, they don't care necessarily if they're attracted to the male performer, because they just care about him as a sexual actor or them identifying with him. And so it doesn't matter as much to them if he's older, if he's whatever. It's just like, can he fuck and can he like create the fantasy that I identify with? So I think that's a lot of why we see older men. And I think a broader version of that in like more mainstream cinema, yeah, you're more likely to see Jack Nicholson with a 20-year-old than you are to see Meryl Streep with a 20-year-old, because again, movies are created by men and often bankrolled by older men, and they want to believe that they are very, very attractive to young women no matter how old they get. And you know, I think people of all ages can be attractive and like whatever. But I would say that's part of what we see. It is so much about men being in the position of actor more than subject. But you know, you do see some porn where you have older women, but it's complicated and it's often fetishized. Like there's the whole genre of quote-unquote MILF, which is older women, where it's this sexual, or cougar or whatever, but it's this whole thing where it's a specialized fetish, and older in porn often means like 30, sometimes 25. It's because who is making these categories, who is making the porn, who is the director, whose view of what is sexy is being showcased in the media.
I think about Ron Jeremy.
Yes, she is a porn performer, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except for Ron Jeremy, right?
Priya, I think you got your wish. Here's a question.
Who?
Here's a question. So with the recent rise of more explicit gay sexuality in films like Call Me By Your Name or Moonlight, do you see this affecting depictions of gender and sexuality in more mainstream films? And I hope the questioner doesn't mind me injecting race in this, because I don't know how you can't.
Yeah.
But anyway, I will throw that out there.
You know, I will say... I might want to defer this question, because this is something I've been thinking about and haven't really formulated a coherent response to. I will say there's, if you want to see something really great in terms of India, there's a brand new movie that's about lesbians, a brand new Bollywood movie. Mm-hmm. Damn. I'll look it up. It's a very long name, but it's something like, you know, When I Met Her, or something to that effect. But, you know, I have a trans Indian student in my Bollywood course right now, and they are just so excited about this film, right? Because they're seeing this representation of themselves, but in a different context. And in India, this is, you know, we've always had like third gender represented in films. That's been part of our history. But this kind of sexuality, which has been seen to come from, again, from the colonial powers, you know, we were never gay. They brought it to us.
you know, to damage us. And so so we're now starting to see, and what I've been interested in is how some of these films in the U.S. That are being screened, and particularly, you know, the popularity, that's amazing to me, how that's intersecting globally. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's something I've been thinking about. And race, oh, the gosh, that's so complicated. Hey, Laura, was your hand up? How I felt when I saw that girl. And it's about this woman who's getting this arranged marriage, but then she falls in love with this other woman.
So I would say, I think certainly in terms of race and to some degree in terms of queer sexuality, we are starting to see more opening up more, and especially because we're starting to see in small fits and starts marginalized people being allowed is such a horrible way to put it, but it is how it is, being given space by the mainstream media to showcase their own visions. I really love Insecure on HBO, and I think it's really fantastic that Issa Rae is being given the opportunity to showcase the experiences and the sexuality of young black women in L.A. I know that Issa Rae is working with, I don't remember his name, but there's a show that's supposed to come out that Issa Rae is producing called Him or Her, which is about a bisexual black man. And that is an experience that we never get to see. I mean, bisexual men just generally tend to be played as a joke or as... Mm-hmm. As someone not to trust, mm-hmm. to the fact that this hopefully will be arriving soon, this show, I'm very, very excited for it. But it's, oftentimes it starts because somebody creates a web series that gets enough traction that they get into a position, or, you know, Netflix is making so much content that just by default you're going to get some of it. I mean, the nice thing about peak TV is that there's so much content that usually somebody is making the thing you want to see. It just might not be getting a lot of attention. But yeah, I think it's slowly starting to change. It's slowly starting to get better, mm-hmm. but it fundamentally has to be about putting more diverse voices and more diverse viewpoints in the director's chair and in the writer's chair, mm-hmm. and behind the scenes as well as mm-hmm. in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again for all of these fabulous questions. Here's another. Can we trust Hollywood, which gave birth to the casting couch and Me Too, mm-hmm. with issues of gender and sexuality?
Good question. No.
There you have it, folks.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to change who's in power.
You have to, yeah, exactly. You have to change, you know, the structure, the way that the institution operates. And, you know, I mean, I would say, you know, it has to begin from the ground up. And to integrate more diverse voices who are in positions of decision-making. And until we have that, and I personally, I don't see that happening anytime in the near future. I mean, you may have films like Black Panther, you may have, you know, Us, which I haven't seen yet and I'm dying to. Is it good?
It's great.
I can't wait. You know, you do have these little interventions, but for the most part, you know, one of the things that Lux was saying is the kind of pathologization of, you know, other kinds of bodies, other kinds of people, that's something that needs to stop at an institutional level. And so I think that's our challenge, is how do we do that? You know, how do we, I'm going to say democratize, you know, how this apparatus, this major apparatus works. And it's a national apparatus, you know.
It's about money, too.
It's about money.
How much it costs to make a film, and who has access.
Right, yeah. Funding is so important.
Okay. What advice would you give young women trying to separate their perception of sex and sexuality from forcibly influenced male-focused art that has shaped how we grew up to view sex?
Could you read that again, please?
Absolutely. What advice would you give young women trying to separate their perception of sex and sexuality from forcibly influenced male-focused art that has shaped how we grew up to view sex?
So I think this is a really, really difficult one because, you know, we're all shaped by the culture that we're in, and it's sometimes, impossible, really, to detangle, like, what is me and what is the culture I grew up in. But I think that, A, I think it's important to think very long and hard about the difference between desire and pleasure, because I think a lot of people, but especially a lot of young women and especially a lot of straight women and young women, confuse the two and see being desired as pleasure. Like someone thinks you are attractive and that, and they want to have sex with you, and therefore that is good sex. And desire, I'm not opposed to getting pleasure or to enjoying being desired. I think that's wonderful. I think a lot of us really enjoy that no matter what our gender or sexuality are. But that is different from pleasure. And pleasure is like feeling the experience of your pleasure in your own body. And that could be something like enjoying having your hair brushed, enjoying getting a manicure. It doesn't even have to be sexual, but physical things that make you feel good, that just spark a good feeling in your body and make you feel for yourself, not for someone else, something really enjoyable. And I think, number one, figuring out the difference between those two for yourself, and then really sitting with what inspires pleasure in you. And it can be a lot of things. And you know what? If your version of pleasure looks like what you see in the movies, or looks like what is also, you know, a man's vision of sexuality, that is okay. If you are choosing that, that is okay. But it really is important to think about, am I choosing this? Is it making me feel good? Is it inspiring pleasure in my body? Or am I going along with this because it's what someone else has told me sex is supposed to look like?
I'd also, I would also say that because it's so expensive to make movies and distribute them, how about reading poetry? It's really cheap. It's cheap to make
and sure.
It's cheap to own, and it doesn't take that long. And so I have two names for you. Depending on your generation, for the middle-aged, actually, it's for everybody. Sharon Olds is still a go-to articulating women's experience, desire, family. And a newer poet, Ada Limon.
I don't know. Can you spell the last name?
The last name is L-E-M-O with an accent like that, N. I think both of those poets, you can find them online, you can find them in your library. And poetry also helps you get in touch with your own emotional life.
Yeah.
It doesn't take you away in the way that cinema often does.
And as the inimitable late Endozaki Shange said, poetry should happen to you.
Oh, yeah.
Like cold water or a kiss.
You know, I would like to, you know, address this question in an incomplete answer in a way. Yeah, I want to go back to one of my favorite movies, Mean Girls. And oh, it's so good. But there's a scene. There are a couple of times there's scenes in there of Regina's little sister dancing in front of the TV. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, right? And this girl is like, what, 8? And she's imitating what she's seeing on screen. And I think that also gets to the heart, partly to the heart of this question. And I think one of the most brilliant things about a film like Mean Girls is that it addresses all of these different topics and challenges the viewer to think about what does it mean when we are sitting, let's say, in a movie theater in a dark, you know, when I saw it, it was me and my first date with the man who is now my husband, and the whole theater was packed with 8th grade girls. It was just the two of us. We were the only adults. And so, you know, it was really interesting to watch that, and subsequently I've watched it about like 100 times, but that particular scene, on the one hand, is you know, I recoil in horror. And yet, I think what they're doing is to draw attention to this very thing. You know, how is it that we're doing this? And, I mean, what I would have liked to have seen is Tina Fey taking it a step further to show that this is fantasy, as you put up, you know, as you put it. And she doesn't go that far.
I also just want to say, Do people remember Nicki Minaj's Anaconda video?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that I thought was really, really interesting when that video came out is that a lot of people were like, oh, she's flipping it. She's taking control. Like, Baby Got Back was really just sexualizing women, and she is like, this is a feminist statement. And I, you know, we can debate the feminist merit of Anaconda. But what I thought was so interesting was that our vision of a woman taking control of her own sexuality was Nicki Minaj in not very much clothing giving a lap dance to Drake. Like, that was kind of what that video was. I'm not opposed to that. I think if that is something that you find fulfilling, that's wonderful. Like, that can be a great way to explore and experience and enjoy your sexuality. But I thought it was just interesting that our grand feminist statement was really, well, it's basically the same thing we've seen over and over again, but she is opting into it and she's twisting it a little bit, but she's doing the same thing. And it really, again, it's not that there's no judgment on Nicki Minaj. Nicki Minaj doing whatever she wants to express her sexuality is great, but it just spoke to the fact that we had such a, we still have such a limited idea of the possibilities that can possibly exist, that this video, which was kind of a tiny, tiny tweak, was positioned as a revolutionary statement. Also, I just want to say I recently got really into the writings of the Women of Wages for Housework, which was this radical anti-capitalist feminist movement in the 1970s. And there's an essay, I think it was written by Silvia Federici, but it was definitely in this reader they recently released. And she's talking about, you know, sex and capitalism, and basically that within the culture that we exist in, all of the sex that we have is framed and shaped by capitalism, by the culture that we're in, that we cannot even imagine what our sex lives would be like or the possibilities that exist outside of this society we live in where our sexual choices are shaped by what somebody thinks is going to sell.
Exactly.
And so I think that that's a really powerful thing to think about the fact that our sexuality could be so much more than we can even conceive of, but we're all very limited by the messages that we're receiving.
Another question. Do you see a difference in how sexuality is being represented on TV as compared to movies with the emergence of online streaming services?
I mean, I'll just quickly say I definitely think there's more diversity just because TV has more diverse creators.
Anyone else want to comment on that?
Okay.
Are girls being forced to grow up too soon because of the sexualization of teens in porn and media?
I don't know if they're being forced, but I think, as the mother of a teenager, the choices that they are making are different and younger.
I mean, I don't know if I agree with that. We had child marriage as a fairly normalized thing a century ago. Like, I think there is a long history of younger people and especially young women being viewed as adult as soon as they hit puberty. So it's difficult for me to say that it is different now. And I think it's also just a really, really thorny question because there is no doubt that young women have sexual feelings. They may not be mature enough to act on them, and they are certainly not mature enough to explore them with adult people. But I think it's very confusing to be a teenager. I think, you know, you feel a lot of things and you don't get good messages on how to explore them, and you want to be sexy, but you don't know what that means, and you don't fully have control over it. But I think that it's always, I don't know that I believe that there was ever a period where young women were allowed to just be children or were allowed to be safe. I think young women have always been sexualized. And it just happens to unfold in different ways. I mean, you know, because we can say, oh, now, like, they have baby thongs. But I have one of my very good friends, Wendy C. Ortiz, wrote a memoir, Excavation, that's about the fact that when she, and this was in the 80s, when she was, like, 13, 14, 15, she was in a relationship with her middle school English teacher. And she dealt with, you know, a lot of these feelings of wanting to be sexual and wanting to explore sex and not and being sexualized by adult men. There's also Phoebe Glockner, who wrote Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is also about being a young teenage girl. In that case, I think in the 70s, being sexualized by adult men. So I just don't know that it's new. And again, that's not to say that I think it's good, because I don't. But I think that women, and especially young women, have always been sexualized and been under this pressure to comport to adult men's fantasies.
I agree, but I think the question asks about choices. And I think young women have different choices available to them.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, just, you know, because I've been doing the kind of work I've been doing for the last 27 years, you know, I think I have a way of, you know, I can think about this in a different way. What I notice nowadays, over the last 3 years, let's say, there's a very different way in which young women and young men are talking about these things and understanding them. You know, I remember when, there used to be this essay that I used to teach about Barbie. Some of you may remember that essay, but it was basically about how young girls, when they would see Barbie, they would want to emulate Barbie, and you know, and that was the influence. So I think, you know, I don't think that's really, at least my experience has been, that that's not really the case anymore. Mm-hmm. But as well, you know, if I could, I was thinking about this also in relation to masturbation and how masturbation becomes something in particular ways that gets demonized, you know, that you can't desire yourself in that way. And I'm thinking about this example of, you know, back in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century at Penn, you know, which has this massive medical school, there were, what was happening was you had these young boys, well, really young boys, and infants up to like 3 or 4 who would be there. And one of the things that they started to do was to say to these boys, so if these boys were caught masturbating, you know, they were restrained, and they weren't, you know, they were told that, you know, whether verbally or non-verbally, that they couldn't, that was a threat. What they would do is they would grow up to be nervous. They would grow up to be, you know, they couldn't run the nation. They couldn't be those actors, you know. And young women have had that too in a slightly different way. And so I think when I think about sexuality too and, you know, what we think about adulthood, in some ways I go back to those early times, and what does it mean, you know, if you are 2 years old and you discover your clitoris, and you're like, damn, this feels good, right? You know, and so, you know, and you see these representations too on TV. I'm thinking about a TV show recently where, you know, this kid was masturbating and his parents came in and they were like, no, you can't do that. You're not allowed. You know, he's like 13, 14 years old. You know, of course you want to explore these things. So I think it cuts both ways. I think, you know, one of the ways I think about it is that we have to think about it in relation to gender itself, not necessarily women. Although women and girls get, I mean, like the preponderance of this stuff, this violence, is upon women.
Another question. Do you find that the panel title, Women in Sexuality, reproduces the harmful framing of women as sexualized bodies?
No. I don't know. I think women owning our sexuality is really powerful. I think that the mere phrase "women in sexuality," I think if it was sexy women, I might have more of a problem with it. But I think giving women space to claim and define sexuality for ourselves is not problematic at all.
Okay.
I agree.
All right. There's agreement there, some consensus. What is, speaking of sexy, what is your favorite sexy movie?
In what way?
Oh.
How are we
elaborate.
Defining sexy here?
They don't elaborate.
Oh, mm-hmm. I have one.
Okay.
Harold and Maude.
That's a really good one.
Any other recommendations?
I'm thinking.
Yeah, me too.
I'm trying to think of something recent.
There's so many movies in the world, and so many of them are sexy. I will not say Federico Fellini's City of Women, which I watched when I was 10.
I mean, the only thing that's coming to mind right now, and this is an old and somewhat problematic choice, but I think Secretary was always like really, really well done. It's Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Spader, and it's like a BDSM fantasy, and it's certainly problematic, like many are, but it's just like really like beautifully done, and I, it's just, you know, oh, I know a movie. I know another problematic movie that I think is sexy that you're not supposed to think is sexy. That one you are supposed to think is sexy, but going back to Widows, Steve McQueen, one of his movies starring Michael Fassbender was called Shame, and a lot of people saw it as like about sex addiction and very upsetting, and I thought that it was a really powerful and kind of sexy movie about this man who fundamentally could not emotionally connect to people and was only able to find human connection through sexuality. And it's not like an uplifting movie, but I just thought this like raw human connection that is on display over and over in that movie where he's just like having all of this casual sex because he cannot connect emotionally. Like, I don't know. I like that movie.
Okay. Priya, I see the wheels turning. That's why I thought, let me turn to you.
Oh, man, there's so many. Rats. I cannot come up with one title right now.
That's okay. If you do later, you know, we'll take it then.
I'll do skywriting.
Yeah, we'll take it then. Well, we're getting close to the end, so what I want to make certain we do is give all of our panelists an opportunity to answer any question, make any statement that you haven't had a chance to respond to anything you've heard thus far. And we can start with anyone. Yeah. Jump in.
I mean, I've been talking a lot, but I'll to make some quick things. I mean, I really think the points that I would stress the most are, again, that film is a fantasy, that the biggest problem is when we only get to see one person's fantasy, and that your sexuality needs to be for you, and if it is, if you are the only person in the entire world who finds something sexy, that's still okay. Because what matters is what gives you fulfillment, and what matters is that the relationships that you have with other people are consensual and mutually enjoyable.
Watch more movies.
In addition to reading poetry, consider that your whole body is a sexual organ.
That's right.
Well, we have a few more minutes. I didn't expect you to wrap up that quickly. But let me at least get this vote in for sexiest movie, Bull Durham.
Oh, that's a good one.
Priya's on board. Bull Durham, because the woman takes charge, ties them up, and makes them listen to poetry.
Yeah, Bull Durham
will not give them what they want until they emotionally, I believe this is connect. So,
thank you.
Well, you know what? We do have another minute, so I'm going to squeeze in yet another question. Do you think that the issue of lesbian porn oriented for male consumption affects both how gay women are treated and how they discover themselves?
Ooh, that's a
good question.
It's a wonderful question, and it deserves more time than we have, but I'd love your
girl
thoughts.
Girl on girl action.
I'd love your thoughts.
I feel like that question has an implied yes, the question is articulated.
I think, I mean, you know, people can come to a sexual fantasy house. However, I think one of the problems with that is that potentially the way it's marketed, it can lead straight men to see women's sexuality, even queer women's sexuality, as for them and for their consumption. And that's a huge, huge problem that, you know, queer women, I think we can all say, we've had experiences with men assuming that our relationships with other women are for them. So I think that that's a problem. But at the same time, I will say, you know, there are straight women who love gay porn, so The problem is, though, that, you know, straight women don't often make gay porn in the way that straight men make porn featuring women with women. And I would say that I recommend, but it's also not that I necessarily think that straight men enjoying watching women with women is necessarily a problem, but I do think that if that is something you enjoy and you are a straight man, I would advise seeking out quote-unquote lesbian porn or queer women's porn that is actually created by queer women to get a sense of what queer women want and how queer women envision themselves. And I will plug the Crash Pad series and Pink and White Productions, who also have pinklabel.tv is their VOD site, and they are based in San Francisco, and they're fantastic, and they do really wonderful pornographic depictions of queer sexuality that I think more people should pay attention to.
One last, and I mean this is it, people. What do you think about writers, creators writing characters that are outside of their experience if it brings diversity on the screen? So, for example, white men writing female characters.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm Indian. Am I only going to write about Indian people? You know? Is that the sum of my experience? You know, but I think it depends on the way in mm-hmm. which it is done. How is it that language impacts the way that certain characters get developed? You know, to what extent are other, you know, what do these collaborations, what could they look like? You know, and I think it has to be collaborative at some level. And I'll just stop there.
I would say that white men writing diverse characters is not a substitute for diverse yeah. people being in writers' rooms. I'm not opposed to people writing their people that aren't their experiences, but when writers' rooms are entirely white men, which they often are, mm-hmm. that's a problem. And it's you inventing a character is not an adequate substitute for you bringing a woman of color or a queer man or someone else into that room and paying them.
And Julia, what are your thoughts about that? Mm-hmm. Okay, folks. As I told you at the start, I'm genetically punctual. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are at the end. I want to thank everyone out there, all of the fabulous questions you submitted. Again, can we thank our panelists here?
Thank you.